Welcome back after your refreshment break. I hope you feel refreshed. So to continue then with the star build-up, how newcomers, contract players were transformed into stars through the Hollywood star machine. In her book, The Star Machine, Janine Basinger insists that every top-of-the-line movie star had to find a type that he or she could play over and over. Typecasting was the dominant practice in Hollywood from the silent era through to the sound era, and from the studio to post-studio era. It had originally been developed in the American theatre, where a lines of business system was established back in the 1860s to supply stock companies with actors to play particular types of character. And Pamela Robertson-Vocic has written about this in her book, in her essay, Typecasting, which appears in the book Movie Acting, The Film Reader, which I've seen lying about here somewhere. Okay, by the 1930s and 40s, typecasting was firmly established as a major component of the Hollywood studio system. It was enforced by the fixed-term option contract, and it was enshrined within the star machinery that discovered and developed stars. Even once the studio system had been broken up in the 1960s, successive generations of audiences revealed a distinct preference for stars being used consistently to play a particular type, rather than stars who diversified their screen role from film to film. This ensured that many actors often appeared in roles that remained consistent with their previous work, even when they took charge of their own casting decisions by directing and producing their own movies. Nevertheless, generations of actors have themselves resisted typecasting. They've hated it. They've wanted to do a greater range of different character roles. And many stars have fought against being typed. Many stars have denounced the practice or cited it as a reason for quitting the film business altogether and going back to theatre. Or it's been one of the reasons why some American stars have stopped working in Hollywood and they've come to work in Europe, for instance, where it's much more flexible. Despite actors' resistance, though, to being typecast, the practice has remained central to the operations of the Hollywood studio system, and it remains so because it guaranteed factory efficiency. And it allowed studios to develop movies called vehicles for their top stars. The Hollywood studio vehicle emerged out of the studio system's attempt to reduce the uncertainty of the market appeal for films. After incurring all the costs of producing the film before its release, the studio needed a way to maximise the probability that audiences would be willing to pay to see their film on its release in the cinema. With no way of knowing in advance how many people would be attracted to these screenings, film production was always a huge gamble for the studios, just as it is to this day. Cinema was a gamble for audiences as well, since there was no way of then knowing if the film would provide a sufficiently pleasurable experience to justify purchasing their ticket at the box office. This was less of an issue when films were short and ticket prices were cheap, but once films exceeded 90 minutes and the price of admission increased, moviegoers wanted some kind of guarantee that their money would be well spent. And the main function of the star was to persuade large numbers of people to part with their money in advance of seeing a film in order to ensure a profitable return on the production, distribution, and exhibition of that film. The star vehicle was a film designed to exploit the popularity of a particular performer by accommodating their established type, This involved both reworking aspects of their previous films that had already proven popular with an audience, while at the same time offering a new twist. The Star Vehicle, therefore, provided a delicate balance between novelty and familiarity, between originality on the one hand and repetition on the other. So, for instance, when MGM hired Gene Kelly in 1941, they initially cast him opposite Judy Garland, who was a big star, in the film For Me and My Gal. This was a hit, and so they cast the two of them together again in The Pirate in 1946. This was less of a hit, however. Meanwhile, Gene Kelly had performed alongside Frank Sinatra in another music called Anchors Away the year before in 1945. And this was a huge hit, much bigger than any of Gene Kelly's previous films. And so they brought those two actors to appear again in On the Town the following year. And again, it proved box office gold. So, and audiences who'd seen Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly in Anchors Away in 1945 were very happy to pay the price of the ticket to see their next film, On the Town, the following year. So it was building upon the repetition, and it was the successful partnering of two emerging film stars at this period, Gene Kelly, the dancer, Frank Sinatra, the well-known singer. Okay. Meanwhile, the partnership between Gene Kelly and Judy Garland began to fizzle out. They made one more film together in 1950 called Summer Stock, and it was very, very clear by this time that Gene Kelly was the big star, the popular star that audiences wanted to see, and Judy Garland was a star that audiences now were less keen to see and less keen to pay, gamble the price of a ticket in order to see one of her films. So her films were slowed down in production at MGM after 1950, and then, in fact, a couple of years later, they cancelled her contract, whereas Gene Kelly's films went into more production around this same period. Okay. So, once a studio developed a star, it would then capitalise on them and capitalise on the investment they'd made in training the star and transforming and remodelling and publicising the star by producing a string of films in quick succession that maintained the winning formula of their most popular films. If it was successful, they repeated that element of it. If it proved less successful, they steered clear from whatever that formula was. And they were always moving towards the more popular format. So this was a formula. A studio's production of several star vehicles a year inevitably led to the standardisation of its products, the same kind of film being churned out year after year, with subtle variation. The studios, however, while this involved repeating the tried and tested as a means of delivering audience satisfaction, it always offered something new. Every film had to provide something different, a twist. For instance, the star might appear in a film of the same genre as her previous one. Or she might play a similar character to the one she'd played in the earlier film. Alternatively, they might change the genre. They might move her from a romantic comedy to a romantic drama while she still plays the same kind of character. Alternatively, they might keep her in the same genre and have her play in another romantic comedy, but this time change the character subtly, or change it from a contemporary film to a historical film. But there would always be some transformation. It would never be exactly the same film. Always subtle variation. Every now and then, after several films, they might even do what they called off-casting, which was to put that actor, that star, into a very different role. So if she'd always been the lovable girl next door, they might suddenly turn her into a glamorous, sexy vamp in her third or fourth film. Or they might transform her into a villainous bitch character, okay? And then take her back. And if it didn't work and audiences didn't like it, they'd go back to the girl next door roles. Okay. But they would only do off-casting after about every third or fourth movie. Otherwise, they'd keep her in more or less the same role. Okay. However, to retain some degree of continuity... move ahead. Move on. Right. So, hopefully you've been recognising the person up there in the last series of screens. You recognise the famous Frances Ethel Gumm, better known as Judy Garland. Okay. So Frances Ethel Gumm was born in 1922 in Minnesota in the United States. She was the youngest daughter of Ethel and Frank Gumm, who were a man and wife, husband and wife vaudeville team, performing in theatres, revues, variety shows around America. Their three daughters were all on stage by 1924, including two-year-old or two-and-a-half-year-old Ethel, who joined her older sister Susie, whose real name was Mary Jane, and her other sister Jimmy, whose real name was Dorothy Virginia, on stage. And after that period from 1924, the sisters performed together as the Gumm sisters, either supporting their parents or in separate acts. So they performed on stage together for 10 years until they renamed themselves the Garland sisters. So actually Judy's transformation into Judy Garland wasn't part of the Hollywood machine. She had already done it herself prior to joining Hollywood. She joined Hollywood the year after in 1935, signing a contract, a seven-year contract with MGM, one of the biggest, most powerful and prestigious studios in Hollywood. Immediately they capped her teeth and they added a rubber extension onto her nose to make her nose seem more aquiline, which is of course exactly what we see happening to Esther Blodgett in her 1954 film, her big comeback film, A Star is Born. In 1936, the following year, she appeared in a short musical comedy alongside the singing star Deanna Durbin, who became a big star at the late 1930s. She had a beautiful soprano voice, classically trained. So they tested the two girls out against each other to see who had the most appeal to audiences. Judy had got a kind of vaudeville style, lowbrow popular culture, and Deanna had got a much more sophisticated classical singing voice. And actually, they discovered from the previews that both girls were really popular together. They were both popular, but they didn't necessarily sit very well together. So after that, they put them into separate films to test out how they would do. And they both did well, and they both then were built into stars. So the next major film for Judy was she appeared in a portmanteau film called Broadway Melody, featuring lots of different stars, and she performed four separate songs throughout the course of that film. She didn't do much acting, she mainly did singing. MGM then teamed her up with another juvenile star, Mickey Rooney, who was already a bigger name by this point, and he had a whole series of films based on a character called Andy Hardy, about a typical American teenager growing up in the suburbs. And so they put Judy into three of his Andy Hardy films. Love Finds Andy Hardy in 1938, Andy Hardy meets debutante in 1940, and then Life Begins for Andy Hardy in 1941. So Judy appeared alongside him in all of those. In 1939, they gave Judy her first major starring role, where her name appears above the title, and that was The Wizard of Oz, which I'm sure you are all familiar with. Yeah? Watch it every Christmas. We'll again be watching it very soon. This was a major breakthrough for her. This was the big film that made her name, made her America's kind of sweetheart. They all adored her after this film, and it made her internationally famous as well. And it's obviously given her a place in film history. In that same year, though, she also appeared with Mickey Rooney in Babes in Arms, which was actually more a showcase for Judy than Mickey. It wasn't one of his Andy Hardy films. It was a separate film, but they were reworking the combination. And it was directed by Busby Barclay, who was a major choreographer of Hollywood musicals, who had moved from Warner Brothers to MGM in the mid to late 1930s. On the back of making those two films in 1939, The Wizard of Oz and Babes in Arms, Judy was awarded her first Oscar. She won the award for Juvenile, Best Juvenile, at the 1940s Academy Award ceremonies. She was then starred in Little Nellie Kelly in 1940, and this was her first adult role. She then co-starred with James Stewart, Hedy Lamarr and Lana Turner in The Ziegfeld Girl, which was a disaster for her, because alongside Hedy Lamarr, who was Hungarian originally,
she's
Hedy Lamarr.
She's quite famous here because she performed the main part in the film
Ecstasy. Ecstasy. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So she was very successful in Hollywood, having established herself in Europe, and she was widely considered the most beautiful star in Hollywood in 1940. And alongside her, Judy looks dreadful. And standing in between Lana Turner, who you might know from The Postman Always Rings Twice, very famous film noir, and Hedy Lamarr, she really looks dreadful. The film did nothing for her in terms of her glamour. But what it did do is it made her seem ordinary. It made her seem less like a star and more like the girl next door. And so from that point on, MGM start to model her into the girl next door, and this becomes her type. And we see that type in For Me and My Girl, which was her star film, her vehicle, alongside Gene Kelly, who was being tried out for the first time. Gene Kelly was not a major star at this point, although he'd had a big break on Broadway as a dancer and performer in the musical Pal Joey in 1940, which he'd won a stage award for that role. But this was his first major role in Hollywood. So it was Judy's film. Presenting Lily Mars was also Judy's film. She was now 21, it was a star vehicle, and she was glamorized, and she was presented to American audiences in a much more glamorous role. So this was trying to do some off-casting to try and take her out of the girl next door and present her with a much more glamorous image. In Meet Me in St. Louis, one of her most successful musicals ever, and again another regular Christmas movie that you may be familiar with, it may be shown here, I don't know. But here she was given a new image, she was restyled, they changed her hairline, they changed the shape of her eyebrows, but she was still playing the girl next door. So, and she's very much presented to audiences as she's not the beautiful daughter. And yet she clearly is more beautiful than she's been in any of her earlier films. But nevertheless, it was actually the younger actress, the juvenile Margaret O'Brien, who plays her younger sister, who actually won the Oscar for this film. And Judy wasn't in the running for an Oscar. So although it's building upon Judy's formula, the movie actually is the big movie for the young Margaret O'Brien, who kind of displaces Judy a little bit from attention. In June of 1945, Judy Garland married her director, Vincente Minnelli, who had directed her in Meet Me in St. Louis, and the following year they gave birth to daughter Liza Minnelli, the goddess, in 1946. In a couple of years later, during the filming of The Pirate, in which Garland is starring with Gene Kelly, who's now making a real name for himself in Hollywood, and she's being directed by her husband, Vincente, Judy had her first major nervous breakdown. The film ran way over production schedule and over budget, and worse still, when it was released into cinemas, it flopped. This was bad news for Judy in a number of ways. Nevertheless, the same year she had a hit with Fred Astaire in the film Easter Parade. So it kept her marquee value high, and she was still bankable at this point. But she was. There were signs of her wavering. Those signs intensified the following year when she was taken off the film The Barclays of Broadway, which was supposed to be her next vehicle with Fred Astaire. She was drinking so heavily, and she was having problems with drugs, particularly her addiction to sleeping pills. She wasn't turning up on time for makeup in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. She was missing. She was holding up the cast on production. And eventually they couldn't stand it any longer, and they said, sorry, you're off the picture. We don't care who you are. She was suspended without pay until she pulled herself together and was able to come back to work, by which time she'd been replaced by Ginger Rogers. And by the way, I've now found another Hollywood star here in the town. I saw a picture of Ginger Rogers this morning when I was on my scouting trip. Okay. In 1948, she also made her last film with Mickey Rooney, this very successful partnership, which had extended from her juvenile roles to her young adult roles. They made a film together called Words and Music. But again, it did very badly at the box office. Nothing like Babes of Broadway or Babes in Arms. She was then assigned to Annie Get Your Gun. She was supposed to be playing the starring role of Annie Oakley in the musical biopic of American cowgirl Annie Oakley. But again, because of her drink problems and her drug problems and her lack of turning up on time, she was suspended and she was replaced by Betty Hutton. And it became a massive success for Betty Hutton, and it launched her as a major star at that time. So that's kind of three films she's been pulled off now. All the alarm bells were going off at MGM that Judy was no longer stable. Gene Kelly was extremely stable at this point. His films were doing better and better with every picture, from Anchors Away to On the Town. So he was put together with her on a joint star vehicle, Summer Stock, in 1950. And again, this is a film that Richard Dyer writes about in his chapter in Heavenly Bodies. This is where you can see the fact her weight was fluctuating. She was putting on weight. She was drastically losing weight. So from scene to scene, she looks physically very different. Again, the drink and drug problems were holding up production. It managed to get through. She somehow pulled it together. She had a break. She slimmed down. She dried up. She came back on set. I told you it would get less dry, didn't I, after a while? So she managed to complete production and do post-production sound, and but unfortunately, the film wasn't a huge hit. It wasn't as big a hit as Gene Kelly's previous films. So MGM realised the major investment in 1950 was Gene Kelly, not Judy Garland. Judy Garland now had the sword of Damocles hanging over her, and MGM were threatening to terminate her contract. She was then supposed to be starring again with Fred Astaire in his vehicle, Royal Wedding, but again, she had to be pulled off and replaced in 1951. It was following that she had her major breakdown, and in fact she attempted suicide, which was leaked to the press, and it appeared in all the papers, which was pretty devastating for her, for America's sweetheart to appear in such a bad condition. And at that point, MGM decided they wanted nothing more to do with her, and that the publicity team couldn't salvage her reputation. Basically, the brand Judy Garland was now invalid. It had destroyed itself. And so they terminated her contract. So she was left now without a film contract, and basically no Hollywood studio wanted to take her on board. So in 1951, she very sensibly hired Sidney Loft, as her manager. She also divorced Minnelli. Their relationship had been breaking up for some time, partly because he was having affairs with other men. She then embarked on a sellout concert tour, particularly in the UK, which did incredible business. She was incredibly successful on stage across the UK. And in October, she returned to Broadway, and she appeared at one of Broadway's most prestigious theatres, the Palace Theatre, and again her concert sold out. So she recreated her star brand through appearances on stage and her ability to work an audience live, performing lots of her well-known Hollywood songs, songs familiar from her Hollywood films. In 1952, she married her manager, Sid Luft, and they formed a company, Transcona Enterprises, which then went into production with what was to be Judy's comeback film, to get her back into Hollywood when no other studio would touch her. So they bankrolled it themselves on the profits they'd made from her concert tour, her stage tour. This was A Star Is Born, which is her own reflection on her career. And it's very clear to all the audiences who saw this film in 1954, this wasn't a star being born, it was a star being reborn. It was a star making a comeback. And in fact, they added in the number Born in a Trunk as a musical biography of Garland. And all the audiences who saw that film in America at the time knew that song tells her own story about being born as part of a family of vaudeville entertainers and working her way through to success through hard work and talent. The film got rave reviews and it earned Garland a nomination for Best Actress Oscar. And this is the first time in many, many years she'd been up there for an Oscar. So it was a big deal. What's really interesting about the film is that it's actually the Norman Maine character played by James Mason who's closer to the star persona of Judy Garland than Esther, than Vicki Lester. The Vicki Lester character she plays in the film is Judy from 10, 15 years ago. Norman Maine is Judy as she was from 1948 onwards. And so audiences were able to read those two characters as both being the personification of Judy Garland. The young pre-breakdown drug problem, weight problem, and the problem Judy, the unstable Judy. Okay. And of course, the big thing about the Norman Maine character is his whole storyline, not just his suicide and his drink problem. The big part of the storyline is how the studio publicists struggle to maintain his brand image, which is something the MGM studio publicists have been doing, struggling to maintain Judy's brand image since 1948. So again, it's her reflection on the damage she's done to her own star identity. And that introduces this notion of the publicity departments, as played in the film by Jack Carson as Willie, whatever his name is, in A Star Is Born there. So the character standing on the right-hand side. By the 1930s, all the Hollywood studios had publicity departments staffed by large numbers of people responsible for constructing and disseminating a star's image across the media, posters, photographs, newspapers, magazines, and radio. These departments were essential to the star-building process, and as a result, they were huge. Each studio had a head of director of publicity in charge of organising marketing campaigns. The most important were Howard Strickling at MGM, Harry Brand at 20th Century Fox, and Bob Taplinger at Warner Brothers. MGM's publicity departments employed no less than, MGM's publicity department employed no less than 60 members of staff, each taking responsibility for three or four of their major stars. Rob Sennett, in his book Hollywood Hoopla, writes that Howard Strickland's staff turned the business of motion picture publicity into a campaign as complex, widespread, and unavoidable as a military invasion. This involved the star in making a series of personal appearances, as well as appearing across the country in posters, trailers, song recordings, newspaper and radio advertisements, product endorsements, and book tie-ins, the book to go with the film. A unit publicist was ordinarily assigned to each film being made when it first went into production. Their job was to create and manage the publicity surrounding the film from the moment it began production right the way through to its release across the world. Articles, gossip and news stories would be placed in the trade press and the general news media by planters to gain maximum exposure. These were designed to intensify audience interest to ensure a sellout opening weekend at the first-run movie theatres. These were the theatres that charged the highest prices for admission. This is where the studio really made its money back on films. Hollywood publicity departments also employed photographers to take flattering portraits of many stars, many of which would be signed and sent out to fans and fan clubs, not always by the star. While part of the publicity team responded to fan mail and liaised with fan magazine editors, others produced the previews of forthcoming releases, writing articles for magazines and newspapers. Meanwhile, another group organised merchandising tie-ins, soliciting product testimonials and endorsements, organising fashion shoots and arranging personal appearances and radio assignments. Other members of the team concentrated on designing all the movie ads and posters for the new releases, providing a range of designs, including international variations, to be distributed to countries around the world. While stars were hired to perform in front of cameras and microphones, they were also contractually obliged to make public appearances and participate in media interviews to promote their films. Many hated this part of their work, but had very little scope to refuse, often being forced to spend a considerable time away from home and family promoting their films in New York and abroad, which they still do to this day, of course. A refusal to comply with these demands could lead to a star being suspended without pay until they complied. Under the terms of the standard Hollywood contract, the period of suspension could be added to the overall term of the contract. And before 1949, this actually meant that a star's contract with a studio could be extended indefinitely, forever, due to long periods of suspension. So however long the star sat out not working on suspension, that period was added onto the overall contract. So that could go on forever if a star just refused to ever work again for the studio. It meant for the rest of their career, they could never work for any other studio, any other film company in any other part of the world, for theatre, for television, for anything, because they'd signed an exclusivity contract. Throughout this period, a star was forbidden from working for anyone. Yeah, I've just said that before. Okay, so Hollywood stars have generated intense public interest since the 1930s, so that by the end of that decade, there were more than 300 members of the press based in Los Angeles, whose job it was to report on a daily basis about the comings and goings and scandals of film stars to the rest of the world. Many of the biggest names in journalism of the 30s and 40s were associated with Hollywood, including syndicated columnists who had art columns in papers all around the country and in other countries, such as Walter Winchell and Dorothy Kilgallen. The most important trade reporters were probably Edith Gwynne of The Hollywood Reporter, one of the most important trade publication for the American film industry, and Mike Connolly of Variety magazine. The top magazine interviewers were Adele Rogers St. John and Sheila Graham, who both worked for Photoplay, probably the most important film magazine in the USA or anywhere in the world in the 1940s and 50s. Okay, and then there were the wonderful gossip girls who I mentioned before. The most powerful reporters in Hollywood were the gossip columnists Louisa Parsons and Hedda Hopper of the Los Angeles Times. Louella Parsons wrote for the San Francisco Examiner. They were feared respected and loathed by Hollywood stars of the studio era because they could make or break a career overnight with a good word or a bad word in their columns. In his book Les Stars, Edgar Morin described gossip columns as the nutritive plankton of the star system, the thing it feeds off. He insisted that they were far more than mere byproducts of the film industry, stating that journalists of the cinema are more interested in the stars than in films, and more interested in gossip about the stars than in the stars. So all they really care about is gossip. He also added that gossip columnists smell out, track down, and kidnap rumours, and if need be, invent them. Meanwhile, P. David Marshall, in his book Celebrity and Power, has noted that transgression is fundamental to a film star's attainment of celebrity status. Very few stars have attained superstar status without transgressing the rule in some way and becoming the subject of gossip and speculation, or even scandal in the press. He observes that, alongside the intensification of media scrutiny of film stars during the course of cinema's history, a whole discourse on their transgressions of the norms of behaviour became available to the public. Information about film stars, marriages and divorces became commonplace in the press after 1920. This included intimations of extramarital affairs, sex scandals, and unusual sexual proclivities. At the same time, the morally questionable status of gossip writing, it's not a very nice thing, is it, writing gossip, was offset by an insistence upon its role as one of the guardians of Hollywood's morality. So gossip columnists knew they were doing dirty business, but they were doing it in the interest of public morality, and therefore it was worthy. So the argument was that gossip columnists, yeah, while they were dishing out the dirt, they were doing it in the interests of the public, for the common good. Paul MacDonald has noted in his book, The Star System, that scandal has long been a feature of Hollywood, dating back at least as far as the divorce stories of such stars as Clara Kimball Young and Douglas Fairbanks in the 1920s, and most notably to the notorious Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle rape and murder trial of 1921-23. Consequently, scandal, gossip and rumour can be regarded as elements of stardom, and they're absolutely fundamental to stardom. As MacDonald has pointed out, the significance of star scandal lies in the way that it divides a star's private life into two distinct components: a publicly controlled private image, and a hidden, secret, private image. While a private life is intended for public consumption, it's private for the public, the real private life of a star is usually kept off limits and fiercely protected. And I'll explain how in a later lecture, particularly when we talk about Tom Cruise. Once exposed, the private life becomes a star's private life, which we all have access to and can enjoy. And a significant part of their publicity and persona is based on this private life. So in the next part of this lecture, after we've had a short break, I'm going to be discussing, to some extent, the complex relationship between a star's persona, personality, and image. And I'm also going to be looking particularly at Bette Davis as an example of a star working under the contract system but fighting against it. Okay, we'll have a 5-minute break. So I'll start again at 15:15. So again, another cigarette, breath of fresh air, run around the building, whatever it is you want to do. Sip of St. Martin's wine. Thank you.
But it's the longer circuit, which I think is intended for 90 minutes. So you can, you have to depart during the last 15 minutes because I think the taxi will take you over the last, you know, like at 12:20 you can leave, I guess. And the taxi will take you right away. I will give you my business card and there the address.
It's perfect, thank you. Brilliant, thank you for organizing that. So how do you pronounce your surname? Dmitrikova?
Dmitrikova.
Why am I not saying it like you?
Because it's the G, I think.
Good. What's different about it?
Dmitrikova.
I'll work on it. Okay.
Do you need anything also?
No. Perfect. Thank you. Everything.
Potom 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 pot
Okay, we'll continue as time is running out. And I have lots to tell you about Betty Davis. This is only the first part of Betty Davis, I will just warn you that. So this is to give you a taster before you see the film Dangerous this evening. Okay, Betty Davis became one of Hollywood's greatest and most successful movie stars, particularly in the late 30s and 1940s, but with a revival of her career in the 60s. She won two Academy Awards for Best Actress, first in 1936 for the film you shall see tonight, Dangerous, and then again 3 years later for Jezebel. And it was only Jezebel she felt she deserved the Oscar. She felt she didn't really deserve the Oscar for Dangerous. You can judge that for yourself when you see the film tonight. She was widely respected in the American film industry during the studio era, and she acquired a reputation for being dedicated, assertive, and even intimidating. Her films are still widely shown across the world now in film festivals, in retrospectives, on film courses, and she and her films are written about a lot within film studies, mostly by me, but occasionally by other people. From 1931 to 1949, she was employed by Warner Brothers, where she was bound by the terms of an option contract that basically transferred all authority to manage her name, her image, and her voice to the studio. This gave her no legal right to determine her star identity. Success in the industry gave her no greater legal claim to influence her work or her public profile. Davis felt constrained by her employment contract, and so constrained, in fact, that she eventually rebelled against it in a bid to achieve some personal control over her work as a screen actress and movie star. Her battles with Warner Brothers are legendary and have been used by film historians to describe the total power of movie moguls over their contracted players. However, a closer look at the struggle between Davis and Warner Brothers in the 1930s reveals that a star could still influence the use of their name, body, and voice, even when bound by the most severe restrictions of the option contract. And I'm going to argue that Davis did achieve some measure of self-determination during this period of her career, exerting some small but crucial influence over her development as a star in the 1930s. As we know, stars had very little claim to their own image or voice once they'd been transferred to print or celluloid. The standard option contract certainly granted them no such right, which was invariably transferred to a commercial or corporate entity. Jane Gaines writes in her book Contested Culture that it's the transferability of rights that is the basis of the mass marketing of the human image and the human voice in the communications industry. And she adds that in contrast with the ordinary worker who leaves the proceeds of his work with his employer, the screen actor may be permanently separated from tangible aspects of personhood, his voice and his photographic license. So when we're paid to do a job, we do the work, we provide the service, we make something, and we give it to the work our boss, and we walk away. We are still ourselves. We are our own person. The difference with actors, and particularly stars, is not only do they give their goods, their services, their performance, but they give their very identity, their image, their body, their voice. Everything is legally transferred to their employer. No other employee suffers, you know, such amount of divorcing from their own control, their own autonomy as the actor. Now, if we take a look at Betty's 1943 contract, and this is cited in Jane Gaines' book, Contested Cultures, she writes that, to quote the 1943 contract, what it says in Betty's contract is this: the artist hereby grants to the producer the right, which shall be sole and exclusive during the full term hereof, to use or make use of and control her name and her professional name, and to use and or distribute her pictures, photographs or other reproductions of her physical likeness for advertising, commercial or publicity purpose, whether or not in connection with the acts, poses, plays and appearances of the artist, or the advertisement or publicity of the photoplays produced hereunder. In other words, as Jane Gaines says, the 1943 contractual agreement that handed to Warner Brothers all rights to the Davis name, voice and likeness is worded in such a way that the studio can claim Betty Davis as its own corporate trademark for 7 years. Thereafter, it's released back to her, and she can sell that on to another studio if she wants. It would seem then that Warner Brothers alone authorised the popular discourse on Betty Davis. Okay, now I'm going to disagree with this. Despite her reputation then as an independent-minded actress, Gaines notes that at this point in her career, Betty Davis was unable to control, authorise, or initiate the commercial uses of her own image. She further notes that this meant that Warner Brothers was wholly responsible for the creation of the star, Betty Davis. And I think this is right up to a point, but I think actually if we look more carefully, we can see Betty did manage to achieve some agency, some control over these things, despite not having the legal authority to do so. Okay. There is little doubt, though, that the option contract enabled the Hollywood studios to exert an inordinate amount of control over their actors in the 30s and 40s. However, there was actually no such thing as a standard contract. All contracts were slightly different, according to the Star. Stars negotiated their own deals, and actors could demand greater autonomy if their reputation had already been established before signing to a film studio. So, for instance, when Paul Muni signed a two-year contract with Warner Brothers in 1932, which is a year after Betty, this was restricted to a total of 8 pictures. So he'd only make 8 pictures for the company. He would receive $50,000 for each film. This contract granted him story approval, so he could choose the script. He didn't have to take on anything he didn't want to do. And he could turn down any role that was offered to him if he didn't like it. His contract also stipulated that he would receive star billing for all the films he made at Warner Brothers, whatever the size of the role. So even if he had a walk-on part for 2 minutes in the film, he would still get star billing for that film because it was in his contract. Should he agree to be loaned out to another studio while under his contract to Warner's, he was entitled to 50% of the fee that the borrowing studio paid. So if MGM wanted to star Paul Muni in one of their films, they would pay Warner Brothers a certain fee to borrow him, which might be $300,000. So it was worth Warner Brothers lending him the money. But they'd split that fee, so Warner Brothers would only get $150 and the other $150 would go to the star, Paul Muni. Very shrewd. This contract also guaranteed him a maximum 21-week year. So he'd only work for Warner Brothers for 21 weeks of the year, and he had the right to take stage work, theatre work, if he desired to do so. The reason that Muni could command such favourable terms when negotiating with Warner's, or when his lawyer negotiated with Warner's, was because he'd already starred in Howard Hughes' successful production of Scarface in 1932, which was one of the top grossing movies of the year. Warner Brothers were so desperate to secure his services at this time and to capitalise on his popularity that they were prepared to offer him a much better deal than most of their other employees. But when Betty joined Warner Brothers in September 1931, a year before, she had relatively little acting experience, with no hit films to her credit and almost nothing in terms of celebrity. So she had no bargaining power. Up until this time, she'd been working in Hollywood for 9 months under contract to Universal Studios, appearing in 6 roles in 6 pictures. 3 of these were loaned out to minor studios. They weren't even made at Universal, because Universal didn't know what to do with Betty. They were so unimpressed by her progress that they basically thought she had no future in the film business, and so after 9 months, they actually terminated her contract, her 7-year contract. They decided, sorry, Betty, it's never going to work. Go back to Broadway, go back to Boston. We don't need you. It was at this point, shortly after Universal cancelled her contract, that Warner Brothers hired Betty Davis to play a supporting role in a prestige production opposite the eminent film actor George Arliss, who had taught Betty Davis in New York when she was at drama school, and he remembered her, and he insisted they hire her for this film to play his young supporting role opposite him, his love interest opposite him. So she got a one-picture deal, that was all, and she was paid a weekly salary of $320 while she was making this film. It took about 2 months to make the film. But after this project was completed, the studio then offered her a 5-year option contract at a weekly starting salary of $400. While the actress was pledged to working exclusively for Warner's for a minimum period of 5 years, not 7, but 5 years, the studio itself could terminate the agreement twice in the first year or for each year after, annually thereafter. So they had six opportunities at which to terminate the five-year contract. But after the first 6 months, they decided to keep her on. And after the first year, they decided to keep her on. Now, there was a clause in the contract that prevented the star being able to renegotiate his or her contract or to renegotiate their salary if they were suddenly to become successful. An increase in the star's popularity would ensure that their option would be picked up each year, that they'd be kept on board. But every time this happened, they would get an increase in salary. But that increase was determined and designated at the start of signing the contract, not thereafter. So, you know, they were on a progressive salary increase, but it was small increments. An exclusivity clause prevented stars from breaking their contract and working for a rival studio or anyone else in the entertainment business, as I've said before. Okay. Under the terms of the contract, they could dictate which, the studio could dictate which and how many projects the actor was to work on. And there was a further clause that stipulated that if the actor refused an assignment, the studio could suspend them without pay and extend the duration of the contract for the full period of the suspension. In this way, a 5 or 7 year contract could be extended over a much longer period, up to 9 years in some cases. Okay. Throughout the 1930s, Warner Brothers regularly suspended Bette Davis without pay when she refused to play her assigned roles. For the first 3 years, she generally complied with the studio's decisions, despite being cast in a succession of unsuitable parts, minor roles in minor movies, which she didn't like having to play. However, in April 1934, she refused to play a role that Warner Brothers had offered her. After receiving a series of increasingly stern telegrams from head office, her resistance crumbled and she dutifully complied. The next project she was offered was another undistinguished role in an inferior movie, and this gave her no resting period between the two films. This time, she ignored the telegrams and she instructed her agent to decline the role on account of it being detrimental to her reputation as an actress. As a result, she was suspended without pay until she accepted the part. She eventually accepted the part. She had no option. She sat it out for as long as she could till she ran out of money, and then she went back to work. In December 1935, she rebelled again when she was instructed to begin work on a new film just 2 days after completing her last one, from which she was exhausted. Her claims of exhaustion were ignored, and she was suspended without pay until she honoured her contractual obligations. Now, it was following this incident that she was nominated for an Academy Award for her performance in Dangerous, which you're going to see tonight. And using this as leverage, she instructed her attorney, she had a lawyer working for her by this point, to demand a new contract from Warner Brothers. Her demands included an increase in salary to reflect her rise to stardom, particularly since she got the nomination for Dangerous. Also, a limit on the number of films she made a year. She was being asked to make about 5 films a year at this point, with no break between the films. She basically wanted to make 3 films a year, with an option to make a film with another studio if such an opportunity came up. Now, her demands at the same time, she also put in a request to be loaned out to RKO, one of Warner's rival studios, to appear as Elizabeth I opposite Katharine Hepburn in a film called Mary of Scotland, which was being directed by John Ford at that time. On the 3rd of March 1936, Warner Brothers rejected her request for a loan out, and 2 days later, she won the Oscar for Best Actress of 1935. So in the eyes of the world, she was a rising star, a prestigious star, a great new talent in Hollywood. But as an employee of Warner Brothers, she was really struggling to achieve any recognition for her success. Emboldened by this success, she instructed her agent to inform Warner Brothers that she would undertake no more roles without a new contract. Refusing to negotiate, the studio assigned her to play the role of a female lumberjack, a log cutter, in a film called God's Country and the Woman. Davis staunchly refused and was suspended without pay. Now, it's quite possible that the studio offered Davis this obviously unsuitable role on the grounds that they knew she would refuse the part, and when she refused their part, they knew they could save money by suspending her without pay until they found a more suitable role for her. And in fact, Jane Gaines writes in her book Contested Culture that studio head Jack Warner, one of the brothers who ran the production operation in Hollywood, was particularly adept at using a technique in conjunction with the contractual provision for suspension as a means of keeping costs down. Basically, Warner would assign a high-salaried actor an unsuitable role. When the actor refused it, the producer would suspend the actor without pay, thus cutting their costs. They didn't have to pay that expensive actor for several months until they came up with a suitable part. So it was a shrewd way of Warner Brothers saving money. It's conceivable then that Jack Warner anticipated Davis's refusal of the role of the female logger, enabling him to legitimately suspend her without pay and save his company the expense of her weekly salary. What he couldn't have anticipated was her acceptance of a role with a studio in England. Accepting a part in a film made at Ealing Studios was a direct infringement of Davis's contract. In such cases, the studio could enforce the contract's negative services covenant, which stipulates that an employee must not work for anyone else during the term of the contract, and hence they could sue for breach of contract. This is exactly what Warner Brothers did after Betty Davis walked out on them and sailed to England to make a film at Ealing Studios. What followed was a court case. Warner Brothers took the actress to court. Many months later, on Monday the 19th of October 1936, the High Court in London granted Warner Brothers an injunction to stop Betty Davis from working for anyone else other than themselves. In the following day's edition of the newspaper, the Daily Mail, Davis declared that, "If I had won, it would have been the greatest legal case in cinema history." 75% of Hollywood contracts, she alleged, were just like her own, and if the court had liberated her from contractual obligations, she claimed that there would have been a mass walkout by actors from all the major studios. As it was, she and the majority of her colleagues were condemned to what had been described during the court case as slavery with a silver lining. This judgment validated the Hollywood contract as both lawful and binding, constituting a victory for Warner Brothers and indeed for all the major Hollywood studios. While it was a defeat for Davis and for all those who were labouring under the same Hollywood contracts, a consoling factor for Hollywood's contract players when contemplating this decision was that that questions had been raised in a British court of law about the fairness of this contract that robbed actors of any control over their professional lives. During the trial, Jack Warner, the vice president of Warner Brothers, admitted on oath in court that under the terms and conditions of the contract, actors could be required to endorse any product in an advertisement or even to attend a political rally for a political party they didn't actually support. He also admitted that the contract enables studios to instruct actors, particularly actresses, young actresses, to appear in publicity material in a state that was revealing and intimate, if not actually vulgar and licentious. Davis's defence lawyer, Sir William Jowett, revealed that when the clause in the contract that added periods of suspension to the original term, clause 23, was used in conjunction with the clause that gave the studio exclusive rights to the actor's professional services across all entertainment media, clause 9, the Hollywood contract became a life sentence. The Daily Mail, popular British newspaper, carried detailed reports of this court case from the 15th to the 20th of October, and headlines included Miss Betty Davis's slavery with a silver lining, and also Miss Betty Davis not a money grabber. Hollywood contract is life sentence, says Sir William Jowett. The Daily Mail ran the court case as a major story over 4 days, featuring it prominently and carrying photographs of the actress, significantly raising her profile in Britain. Many British people discovered Betty Davis for the first time through these newspaper reports, having never seen her film before. But from this point on, they would want to see her film, so it significantly changed her image. Now, up until this time, the image that Warners had created for her was that of a glamour girl, a seductress, a vamp, or as a talented but self-destructive actress. And the only one of those that Davis herself felt comfortable with was the last one, the talented but self-destructive actress that you will see her playing tonight in Dangerous. All the other films she thought were trash because they were trying to make her into a platinum blonde, a dumb blonde, which she wasn't. She couldn't fit that type, but that's the only type they could find for her at this time. Okay. Some of her publicity is really interesting from this period. In the British magazine in 1935, before the court case, she's reported as saying to her fans, "Until recently, as you know, I played a long series of sophisticated, stereotyped roles. Nearly always the girlfriend with strong ideas on how to manage men. After playing a very different role of Mildred Rogers, the contemptible Cockney waitress in Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage, which she loved playing, it was the first really juicy part she'd had. She didn't make it at Warner Brothers, she made it on a loan out to RKO. Davis declared, apparently, the publicists say, "I want to go back to my nice, smartly dressed secretaries, lady journalists, commercial artists, and understanding girlfriends for a while." As if she really did. "Let's face it," she says, "it's useless to disguise the fact that to become popular and keep her popularity, a Hollywood actress has to establish a definite screen style, an identity to which one must frankly attach the horrible description, type. Once she has discovered a style which the public acclaims, she must remain more or less the same little woman in every picture she makes. Rather, more or less, too." Okay, now, if we believe that's true, and we shouldn't believe it's true, she's saying she's happy to play her typical secretary types, the stuff she'd been getting suspended from a contract from. She clearly didn't want to play these roles. Okay, but the publicists are declaring she's happy playing these roles. In the court case, though, it's a public demonstration of how unhappy she was having to play those roles. So the court case worked against all that publicity department rubbish, okay? And it told the truth about Davis for the first time. Now, what's interesting is after the court case, Davis was forced to go back and work at Warner Brothers. But for the first time, Warner Brothers gave her a really meaty role, a role she could really get her teeth into. She plays a character, a prostitute, basically, in the film Marked Woman, who gets beaten up by a bunch of gangsters. And what does she do? She takes them to court and she wins. Now, audiences knew that Betty Davis had just been to court and she'd taken Warner Brothers to court, but she'd failed. But the movie version turns the whole thing around. But what Warner Brothers are doing cleverly are they're capitalizing on this publicity. It's not publicity they're generated. It's not where they wanted to go. It's where Betty wanted to go. But they're now using it to their own advantage. The film is a big hit. It gets rave reviews. The reviewers in Variety say, regardless of what happens to the picture financially, it cannot help but react favourably to Miss Davis. And in the New York Times, the critic there writes, Miss Davis has turned in her best performance since she cut Leslie Howard to the quick in A Human Bondage, i.e. better than her role in Dangerous, which she won the Oscar for. So this is seen as her best film to date. From this point on, Betty Davis becomes a major star. She finds a new type, which is the rebellious young woman. And that's personified in her first major star vehicle, Jezebel, 1938, which she wins her second Oscar for, the one she truly believes she won the Oscar, she earned the Oscar. And again, in Film Weekly, where those silly publicity reports had been coming out in 1935, saying she wanted to play her types, there the critic Frieda Bruce Lockhart wrote that Betty Davis has at last won the battle which her film career has been. Okay, it's recognition. She's fought Warner Brothers. She lost the court case, but finally she's won because she's now become the star she wanted to become. She's fought against her old types. She's not playing secretaries anymore. She's playing the rebel. She's become Battling Betty. It's a new star identity. And she's created that, not the publicist, not the studio, no one else. Betty Davis, by walking out on her contract, coming to London, ending up in court, has carved out for herself a new identity. Warners shrewdly capitalise on it and give her a whole series of films marketing Battling Betty. And that becomes important after 1939 when Britain and America need a war heroine. They need someone who can go to battle. Betty is that heroine. And she's the most successful Hollywood star throughout the Second World War. So Betty did that. So I think even though legally she had no control over her image, she found a way to work around the contract to claim some sort of control over her work. Okay. In the next lectures tomorrow, I'm going to be looking at what happens to stars once the studio's broken down and they're not signed up under the same contracts anymore. And they become in charge of their work because more and more the stars become the directors and producers of their own star vehicles. But for now, I hope you enjoy Dangerous tonight. And if you don't like the movie, you'll probably find the ending unbearable. It is. It's one of the most ridiculous endings of any film. So feel free to have a really good laugh at it. But what you will see is an actress on top form who's battling against and frustrated against her studio at this point and has yet to make the breakthrough of this new persona of Battling Betty. So it's a movie full of tension, I think, her own frustration with the part she's having to play. Okay, enjoy that film.